Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I am Robert Silverman. I am the appellant, and I am pro per. This case really has three fundamental issues before you with regard to the anti-SLAPP section under CCP 425.16. And that is whether or not these five plaintiffs in this particular case were my clients, and whether or not there was, in fact, an attorney-client relationship. I believe that is the major threshold question before the Court.
But it's not here exactly on the merits, right? It's here as to whether there's a colorable claim.
Your Honor, I'm not quite sure I understand your question.
We're dealing with prong two of the SLAPP motion requirement, which doesn't require that we decide that question. It only requires that there have been a sufficiently colorable showing.
Actually, Judge Cronstadt found that there was no free speech violation.
I understand that, but that doesn't matter, does it?
It does not, because you have de novo review over
this. No, it doesn't matter because there's a second prong.
There is a second prong.
Okay.
And we believe that Judge Cronstadt did not sufficiently evaluate the
second prong. So that was what I was trying to say. So let's go back to that.
Okay. Would the Court like me to focus
on the first part? Doesn't matter if the showing on the second part was adequate. And the showing doesn't have to be that they were your clients. It has to be that there is adequate evidence in the record to make that a colorable claim.
Yes, I agree with the Court that while the client situation is a threshold question, because if they're not my clients, they have no basis to assert attorney-client privilege, which fundamentally affects the anti-SLAPP motion. But it does circle back under the second prong as well, whether or not even if they have proven that they are subject my clients and entitled to an attorney-client relationship, there's still an issue is have they met their burden. And I believe, and we have argued and set forth, that they have not met their burden.
As to what?
Excuse me?
Met their burden as to what?
Well, they made three particular arguments, one of which is that they were charged an excessive fee for the services that were delivered. The record before the Court is simply that they paid approximately $2,000 for attorney services. In their own declarations, there's only three plaintiff declarations submitted in opposition to the anti-SLAPP motion. The Court is once there's a shifting of the burden for prong two, it is to the plaintiff to prove their case, not necessarily a prima facie, but they have to do more than that. They have to show that they have the basis of succeeding, because the whole purpose of the structure of an anti-SLAPP motion is to prevent litigation, prevent unnecessary litigation. It's not merely to show up before the Court and say, yes, Your Honor, look at our complaint. We've set forth all of this. And Judge Cronstadt literally looks back at the complaint for a large portion of his position in his ruling. And that's not sufficient. So what you really have before the Court to analyze the plaintiff's position are three declarations, not five declarations from the plaintiffs, but three declarations. And all that declaration says is literally, I paid money to some third party with the expectation that I would get attorney services. The fee that they paid is $2,000. If we're going to have a discussion of excessive fee, it's for the plaintiffs to put forth to the Court expert testimony to justify that, in fact, that fee is excessive. The plaintiffs didn't do that. There is no declaration from any expert that says even if they paid $2,000, that that's an excessive fee. The other issue that
I thought the claim was not so much that it's excessive, but that they were required to pay for fees that should have been borne by the employer, right?
Yes, and that was one of their other arguments that they put forth as to the basis of malpractice. And this is where Judge Cronstadt clearly erred in his analysis, in that he asked for supplemental briefing on this case. This is the issue of whether or not the plaintiffs paid fees that they should not have paid is really an issue between themselves and the school district. The school district, their employer, is obligated to pay them a prevailing wage. The prevailing wage is established by the Department of Labor through a very sophisticated process of submitting a labor condition application, and they look at the job position, they look at the jurisdiction in which the person will be performing the services, and they say to the school, yes, you meet the prevailing wage, that's a minimum that they have to pay. In this particular case, these teachers actually received above and beyond the minimum. Because they were credited with having a master's degree or they're teaching in the Philippines, they were actually paid above the minimum, the prevailing wage, which is the base amount. So what happens is, even if there is a violation under the CFRs, their obligation is to file a Department of Labor complaint. The Department of Labor would then investigate that. And in fact, the plaintiffs did file a Department of Labor complaint. As far as I understand, the Department of Labor did investigate these schools. To my knowledge, there has never been one violation issued by the Department of Labor.
Is that in the record?
Yes, it is in the record. So in this particular situation, they don't have the basis to allege that I've paid fees that I shouldn't have paid until the Department of Labor verifies that. But even if the Department of Labor verifies that, the answer is the school district would have to pay.
Why the Department of Labor has to verify it?
Because what would happen is, any fees that they pay that the law says they shouldn't pay would lower the prevailing wage that the school district is actually paying them. Mm-hmm. That's the only jurisdiction specifically rests with the Department of Labor, and that's under 20 CFR 655.740.
Can I switch gears for I'm just looking at one of these notice of appearance forms that the court relied on to find that, in fact, these plaintiffs were your clients. I understand your position is that you never represented them as individuals. You only represented the employer, but both the boxes are checked.
They are checked.
And I'm not sure how we could say that the court erred in finding that these people really were your clients on the face of those documents alone.
Well, we have to consider 8 CFR 103.2, which is controlling. And what's controlling, because it even says it controls on the form, is that the beneficiary in this particular case does not make an appearance in the application process, in the petitioning process with USCIS.
Well, why does that matter? You still could be representing them.
You cannot use the basis of the G-28 to establish my representation.
Why was they asking you then?
I'm sorry?
Why was there even a box for that?
You would have to ask the people who designed
the box. Why did you check the box?
We checked the box, and I put that in a declaration with regard to the anti-SLAPP motion, because we were, for EBR, for existence, I think they had about 300 teachers. It's a security concept. The fact is the school district signs off on my representation for them for a particular file. Otherwise, you're stuck with a blank representation that could be used.
I'm sorry, I don't understand what you said.
You're representing to the body that this is being submitted to that I hereby enter my appearance as attorney for, and then you check the beneficiary, and the person's name is right there. So are you saying that's a false representation?
It's not a false representation. It's a documentation for security purposes. But the school district has to sign off on that. So if you don't have the teacher's name on this form, the school district is signing a blank representation. I would not misuse that, but there are people along the way who would misuse that. And in fact,
I'm really not understanding that the form is going to the government. It's not going to the school board.
No, the school board signs off on it to acknowledge that I represent the school board for that particular file.
Right, which has a name. I mean, it has person. It could be on behalf of somebody, but that doesn't require that you say you're representing that person.
There's no other place on the form to put that I represent that person. Otherwise,
you're saying you don't represent that person. There's no place in the form that says this is school board submitting a form to get a visa for Joe?
Not on the G-28, no.
Well, I'm also troubled, I guess, by the correspondence that's in the record. It relates, albeit to different teachers, but you represent plain as day that you represent not only the school district, but the individual teacher.
But those are very unique situations that did not necessarily apply to the five plaintiffs that are before the court.
I thought this is a class action, by the way.
It was pled as a prospective class action.
It has been certified?
Unfortunately, after the filing of the appellate, which placed a stay, Judge Cronstadt did, in fact, certify.
It has been certified.
It has been certified during the stay of this case, while this appeal was pending. Mm-hmm. So at the conclusion of this, I suspect to take some action, but I haven't been able to take any action because there is a stay in place.
Can I just back all up for a minute, although I said I wasn't that interested in the First Amendment part of it. And I don't understand. There seems to be maybe some case law saying this, but why does a lawyer in a representative capacity have any First Amendment rights?
In this particular case, this is a petition to the government. It's not a typical malpractice.
But it's a petition on behalf of you. I mean, I can understand a theory that said, well, you essentially are asserting the First Amendment rights of your clients, but I don't see why you have a First Amendment right.
Well, I would refer the court to the Mindy's Cosmetic case, which is
well-cited. I understand
that,
and it kind of assumed that. It didn't address it, but it seems to have assumed it. But it seems very odd to me because you're basically operating in a business. You're not even expressing your own views. You're not you're a shill, essentially. You're there for on behalf of your clients. They may have not, the views expressed may not be your views, and I don't
understand. Aren't they the real petitioners? I apologize. Aren't they the real petitioners?
The school board is, and therein lies the inherent problem of this case. Is why am I being sued for an issue of malpractice while representing the school board?
No, but how can you, I think, and I apologize for interrupting the judge, but how can you, where do you get standing to assert a First Amendment violation?
Well, at this juncture, I'm being sued for my actions of filing a petition on behalf of a client.
But on behalf of, exactly. It's not on behalf of you. You're not, the whole point of petitioning is that you're going and expressing your views to the government. You're not expressing your views to the government. You're a lawyer.
Well, I would position this, that if you are correct, Your Honor, that we shouldn't be here before the court because there should be no basis for this
case.
No,
I'm saying the opposite.
But
I'm saying I don't see how you get to slap at all.
Well, the courts and the cases and the Supreme Court of California has basically said you can have anti-slap motions in these particular cases. It specifically addressed the issue of attorney malpractice in the Nevier case. And in Nevier, it basically says there is no prohibition against any particular type of cause of action. And in fact, the Ninth Circuit in the Mindy's case, in a very similar situation where somebody basically filed a trademark on behalf of somebody else, the court did find in the first prong there. The court specifically found in the first prong.
Yeah, and it didn't
prong.
Deal with this problem because nobody seems to have worried about it, but I'm now worrying about it.
Well, all I can go by is the Mindy's case, Your Honor. In the Mindy's case, a very similar type of activity was considered to be protected First Amendment speech. Now, in that court, they did actually find under the second prong, but the first prong of being it free speech and constitutionally protected, the court did acknowledge that that prong had been met. I'm past my time, so I don't know.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Sam Brook from the Southern Poverty Law Center on behalf of the plaintiff appellee teachers. Judge Berzon, on the question that you're raising about the right of a lawyer to exercise First Amendment activity, I think that the California courts have been clear. You start with the Pretty Wave case, which was cited in the Mindy's case, wherein Pretty Wave says there is no slap applicability to a case for legal malpractice where it is the former client who
right,
is served.
Right, but of course I'm suggesting something broader. I'm saying that it's not at all clear to me that a lawyer who is acting on behalf of a client, even if not in malpractice, is doing petitioning activity on his own behalf. Now, I can imagine a Roe versus Wade-like theory that says, nonetheless, he should be able to assert the First Amendment rights of his clients, and that may be enough for a slap motion. But it appears to be more complicated than saying that he's doing petitioning activity, because I don't think he is.
I agree with that. And I guess the point that I'm trying to make is that when the cases have consistently held, the California cases have consistently held, that where a former client is suing their attorney, the slap statute doesn't apply because you fail on step one, that is implicitly recognizing, I think, the issue that you're pointing to. And this wasn't just in the Predawave case. After the Mindy's decision came out and after our briefing was in late in 2012, there was another California appellate court decision, Chodos v. Cole, and that's at 210 Cal App 4th 692. And Chodos points to Mindy's, but then reiterates the same point, that when clients are suing their former attorney for legal malpractice, that is not covered under Step 1 of the SLAPP statute, precisely because in a malpractice case, you're not suing for the petitioning activity, you're instead suing for the lack of legal representation through that process.
Inadequate performance. I'm sorry, Judge, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Just, you're suing for inadequate performance.
That's correct.
Yeah. And I think Judge Berzon's point, and I think I share it, is where does Mr. Silverman or any other lawyer get standing? The person who's exercising the First Amendment rights is the applicant for the visa. And the lawyer is simply applying his or her skills to enable that client, that individual, to exercise those rights by seeking relief from the government.
I completely agree. I think
disagree with me, but go ahead. Go ahead.
I mean, what would happen is then the legal malpractice claim, of course, would fail. You would fail under 12b-6, right? You wouldn't be able to state a legal malpractice claim if you weren't, in fact, the client of the lawyer. But once you move past that, you know, the SLAPP statute shouldn't apply where you had that attorney-client relationship.
Judge Washington.
Well, can you address obviously we're assuming then that your clients were his clients.
Right.
He obviously argues to the contrary, and you don't have a whole lot of evidence other than allegations to that effect. So maybe you can address why what we've got before us is enough.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, as you all recognize, we can move immediately to Step 2 and affirm just on that basis. But under Step 2, it's a minimal merit test. You know, all we have to do is put forth a prima facie case. We do have to produce evidence, but we did produce evidence, three categories of evidence. First of all, declarations from the plaintiff teachers stating that they were told that they would have an attorney and that they would pay all of the fees for the attorney, not just the $2,000, but also all of the fees related to the application process. Then we move on to the notice of appearance forms that you all had been discussing previously. You know, not only did Mr. Silverman check both boxes, but also, if you look at those forms, they just have empty spaces to list as many or as few parties as necessary. There was no reason that Mr. Silverman had to list the beneficiary, and certainly no reason he had to say that he was representing them. You know, you can see one of these forms at page 6 of the supplemental excerpts of record. If you go on to pages 7, 8, and onward, you see the actual immigration application. In that application, they are required to state who the beneficiary is because the USCIS has to be able to notify the embassy in Manila, hey, there is a teacher who we've approved the visa for. This is their name. When they come in, make sure that this is the person who appears. All of that information for the individual is on the visa application form. Thus, you know, the concerns that Mr. Silverman is raising about fraud, you know, I don't think withstand, you know, examining the documents. But even if they did, under the second step of the anti-SLAPP analysis, you need to fully credit all of the evidence in our favor. You need to draw all reasonable inferences from it in our favor. And Mr. Silverman can later, at a later stage in the case, try to argue to the contrary why his admission where he states that he is their attorney shouldn't be fully considered and credited. But at this stage, it is sufficient and more than sufficient to satisfy our burden to be permitted
now,
to move forward.
Mr. Silverman to also be arguing that even so, there isn't a prima facie case of malpractice or anything else actionable alleged. Where in the complaint are those? I saw the factual part, but where is the claim that pertains to Mr. Silverman and his malpractice?
In the Second Amendment complaint, Your Honor?
Yes.
I believe it's in counts 6 and 7. It's, I believe, paragraphs 381 to 388 of the Second Amendment complaint. And in there, we lay out the specific allegations. I think that, you know, we use a heading there. We define early in the complaint where we define the parties that they are the, you know, legal participants. And so we refer to Mr. Silverman in that way, not directly by name, but it's referring specifically to Mr. Silverman and to Silverman and Associates.
So obviously at this stage, the allegations in the complaint aren't enough. So what evidence did you produce with respect to the malpractice complaint?
Correct. So the evidence that we produced on behalf of malpractice was, number one, we've already discussed the attorney-client relationship. But as to malpractice, then, we have the declarations from the teachers stating that they paid all of these fees. And, you know, Mr. Silverman was talking about the prevailing wage. You can see the allegations and how we discussed that both in the supplemental briefing but also in in our brief at pages 12 to 14. But let me give one very concrete example. The teachers state that they paid a $500 anti-fraud fee, that they were required to pay that fee. As a matter of law, under statute and on the immigration forms, that fee had to be paid by the employer. You can see this in the statutes at 8 U.S.C. 1184 C-12A. You can also see this explicitly on the immigration forms, where it says this $500 anti-fraud fee must be paid by the employer petitioner, page 13 of the supplemental.
Okay, but let's assume all that's true. How does that mean that he did something wrong, though?
Because he was, you of course have to agree with us that we have provided sufficient evidence that there was an attorney-client relationship between Mr. Silverman and the teachers.
Okay, well, accept that.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
But you also have to infer that he was the person to whom these fees were being paid, and that he was the person and that he was somehow responsible for the fact that they were paid to him.
Well, that's true. But again, we're at a minimal merit stage. That's all that we have to produce here. We have the teachers stating that they were in the Philippines, that they were told by the recruiter defendants that they would be arranging for them a lawyer in the United States, that the recruiter defendants were collecting all of these fees and the $2,000 lawyer fee to go to that lawyer. And then we have the notice of appearance forms.
Let me stop you right there.
Yes.
What's the evidence that he's responsible for these people having to pay a fee that they shouldn't have paid? You just described it as the employer defendants are the ones who were extracting this unlawful fee, but I just don't hear the evidence that he was the one responsible for that, for your client's paying that fee.
Mm-hmm. Well, and so a slight modification, the recruiter defendants, so the universal placement, the recruitment company, not the employer defendants, but point well taken. I think it was Mr. Silverman's obligation to, of course, understand what the immigration law was, and he certainly...
Do we know that he got paid?
I'm sorry?
Do we know that he got paid?
Well, we do. I'm not sure that we have anything in the record explicitly.
What do you mean? I mean, it could be that they took the $2,000 and put it in their pocket.
It could be. But again, at this stage where there's, I say could be in the sense that we don't have an explicit anything in the record that says that shows Mr. Silverman's bank account that has the money deposited in it at this stage.
Anybody saying that he was paid to do this? Is anybody saying that he was paid to do this?
Mr. Silverman himself isn't even contradicting that he was paid. He says in his declaration, I'm sorry.
But you need evidence.
Well, we have evidence that the teachers paid money for a lawyer. We have evidence.
For a lawyer, not to these recruiter people.
Well, for a lawyer. But then we have evidence that Mr. Silverman entered notice of appearance forms. Mr. Silverman wrote correspondence to third parties stating that he was the lawyer. I think that would be more than sufficient under the minimal merit standard to conclude that he reasonably was the lawyer that the teachers were paying for. If the teachers, whether he got all the money or only part of the money, he clearly was understanding that he was acting as their lawyer.
So the malpractice, the way you plead it, is getting this money, which the evidence is relatively flimsy, and procuring one-year rather than three-year visas, and then generally otherwise participating in facilitating the trafficking. That's the complaint. What is there in the record that's more specific? Anything else?
No, just the declarations from the teachers stating that they paid these fees and that these fees were the legal obligation of Mr. Silverman's other clients.
Is that malpractice?
Well, I think it is. I mean, Mr. Silverman, of course, had to act zealously and look out for the interests of all of his clients. And if he was permitting a situation where one client was paying the fees that were the legal obligation of the other, I think that that's enough to make out a prima facie case that those clients were adversely affected by his performance. He, of course, we would assume, we would expect a competent immigration attorney to know the immigration laws, to know the statute, to know the forms that say these fees are to be paid by someone else, and for him to then not provide any...
The 1 year versus 3 year. I understand that. Do you have any expert or anybody saying that any competent immigration lawyer would have gotten a three-year visa? Do we know they could have gotten a three-year visa?
Well, at this stage, we don't. But again, we're at the prima facie slap statute. I don't think that we should be expected to produce an expert at this stage. We can talk about that later when we get to the actual merits.
And you're alleging, if I understand correctly, you're alleging that that was a conscious decision to forego the three-year so that more control could be exercised over these teachers.
That's right. And
therefore, it would be... I mean, the way I read the allegation was that there was basically a conflict of interest, and that, by my definition, satisfies your pleading requirement because you've shown, hey, wait a minute, he's working on behalf of two sides here, and he was benefiting the school district in disadvantageous, the contrary, adversely affecting the teacher's interests. I have another question, and that is there any other lawyer anywhere in the record to whom these monies might have gone? Did the school board, did anybody else have any lawyers signing anything at all in this whole process?
No, there certainly is not. And again, the facts that Mr. Silverman submits is that he contends he's employed by the school district. He never says anywhere in the record that he was paid by them. I think, again, the only reasonable inference is that the monies that was collected from the teachers in the Philippines went to the lawyer who then later represented that he was representing both him and the school districts in the immigration application process. I see that my time has expired. If there are no
questions. I have, if I may, one other question, if I may. Where does this fit on sort of the initial burden about the minimum merits or whatever? Is it more than probable cause, less than a preponderance, reason? How do you define that?
It's usually referred to as kind of a mirror summary judgment standard, basically whether or not we could survive a summary judgment motion brought by Mr. Silverman. It's also sometimes referred to as the directed verdict standard. So, I haven't seen a corollary to saying probable cause, but it's saying, based on the records, based on the facts that you have produced, could a reasonable finder of fact possibly, under any circumstance, rule in our favor? And that's all that the standard requires, and I think that we have amply satisfied.
And I gather that the problem that you have faced is complete lack of any opportunity to take discovery.
That's right. Everything has been stayed against Mr. Silverman because of this appeal. We proceeded to trial against the other defendants, the recruiter defendants, in December while this appeal was taken and obtained a judgment against them subject to post-judgment motions. But we haven't been able to do that yet, of course, against Mr. Silverman.
Did not interpose slap motions.
I'm sorry?
They did not interpose slap motions.
They did not. And I don't think there would have been any basis for the recruiter defendants to have done so. But.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Silverman, we'll give you a minute.
Thank you. I know you give 1 minute, but I would ask to indulge the court for maybe like 2 to 3 minutes, and I will try to be as brief as possible. There's two scenarios that I really need to address with the court. And it's the whole process for the court to understand is that teachers in the Philippines say they see a job posting, I'm interested. They do a little bit of a process to be pre-qualified. The school district goes to the Philippines and interviews the teachers personally and offers them a job. That job that is offered is a 1-year job. Once that person accepts it, it's a 1-year opportunity to prove themselves with the school district. Mr. Silverman, being me, is nowhere involved in this process. I'm not even a thought in anybody's mind. The reason why this is so important is because the labor condition application, referred to as the LCA, then becomes the first document that's filed in this process. That first document that's filed has to mirror the job offer. The job offer is for 1 year. They're not asking Mr. Silverman, should I take a 1-year job offer or should I take a 3-year job offer? The school district did not offer them 3 years. The school district offered them 1 year. That then gets reflected on the LCA. The LCA, once approved by the Department of Labor, becomes the backbone of the petition that then gets to me.
Are you saying that if the employer offers a 1-year job offer that you as the lawyer could not petition for a 3-year?
Correct. But in this case, I would direct the court to 8 CFR 214.2 small h v. And in that particular code section, it states that you cannot get more than a 1-year visa unless you have a license. These are teachers. They have to be licensed by, in this case, the state of Louisiana. If it was California, they'd have to be licensed by the state of California. The state of Louisiana could not give them a license until they were physically present in the United States and had obtained a Social Security number. So all the state of Louisiana could say to USCIS is simply they're eligible for a license once they get here. When you look at 8 CFR 214.2 HV, that's the guideline that says in those particular situations, you can only have a one-year visa. They were not eligible for a three-year visa. And these are the points of why I'm saying Judge Cronstadt failed in the analysis. This is by law, they're not entitled to a three-year visa. And factually, I, as an attorney, was not even in the picture to be consulted with or to be discussed with at the time they were being offered a one-year job placement. So they were, for factual reasons and legal reasons, it fails. And this is why an anti-SLAPP is important, because they can't prove their case. They will not prove their case, and they will not meet a summary judgment standard. And a summary judgment standard is not simply a prima facie case. It's putting forth admissible evidence to sustain the allegations.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For useful arguments, the case of Tanada versus Silverman is submitted.